Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And, you know, Mike, I think you're with me and that I'm really excited we get to talk about some new movies because, you know, since the pandemic, you know, it's been sort of a difficult time trying to find things that can be viewed. But I know you've been back in the theater and I'm still streaming, although I've gone back to the theater as well. So today we're going to talk about Dream Horse, which came out in 2020, and The Dry, also from 2020. So let's start off with Dream Horse. Now, when we talked about doing this show, Mike, we talked about how these two movies would be our, you know, the British Commonwealth theme. And this movie is a story from Wales, a true story about a racehorse. It's a rags to riches story about a group of ordinary folks who go in on a racehorse, even though, as one of the people investing said, that she knows sod all about horses or horse racing. Now, this is actually, in a way, it's a remake of another movie called Dark Horse from 2015. So let's start there, Mike, in terms of, you know, it's only been 5 years since Dark Horse came out. Why remake Dream Horse at all?
Well, to answer that question, Dark Horse is actually a documentary, really. So it gives more of the factual aspect of it. And this is the more fictionalized treatment of it. But just to preface my remarks and doubling back on what you were saying, Marie, I'm thrilled to be talking about new movies. It's been like it was so painful to have films either not released or just released on various platforms. But I'm old fashioned. I like to go to movie theaters and I'm an art house maven. So I've been at the Charles Theater in Baltimore since it reopened, seeing everything. And there's a backlog of films. So if we could, like, just for a moment dwell on that, like the films we're talking about today, this one, Dream Horse, came out in 2020. But this is a case where the distributors decided to hold back so it could have some kind of theatrical release as well as additional platforms. And it really helps to have, you know, people in a theater. And I would like, frankly, to see more people in the theater. But when you have, like, you know, that spontaneous live response to something. And the other thing I'd want to say in a prefatory sense is Dream Horse very neatly fits within a genre of sports underdog stories. And I wanted to, like, talk about that a little bit and then redouble back on what we were starting to say about the film itself. I've got to confess that I'm not a big fan of the genre, if you will. And admittedly, on a very personal level, I'm somewhat of a sports fan, but not exactly a fanatic, right? So it's not exactly what I'm looking for every week in terms of, you know, sporting events and movies about the same thing. But the other thing that has me lukewarm at best about the genre is, admittedly, when you talk about genre, you're talking about formulas. But how many genres are, you know, as formulaic as this one? In other words, like you could point to almost any genre and say, well, there's a predictability. This is going to happen. That's going to happen. Character types, whatever, thematically, technically. But you know what? When you talk about sports underdog movies, come on now, you can hear the Rocky soundtrack as I'm talking. Sometimes they're so predictable that I just feel like even if, like, everyone around me is getting all revved up, you know, will he win the boxing match? Will the horse win? Will this, will that? I'm sitting here thinking, well, of course, you know, it's the last, I mean, it doesn't always play out that way, I realize, but it's that last minute victory as if it were a big surprise to us. So oftentimes with character types, and boxing is actually the really best example to give, like, who's in your corner? You know, who do you have a Burgess Meredith type? I mean, who's there, like, in your corner for it? And what are you like as an underdog boxer and all the hard knocks you go through in your personal life and those parallels between in the ring and out of the ring? Okay, sometimes it's really well done and exciting. I mean, you know, Raging Bull is arguably not even a boxing movie, but if it is, you know, it's a classic. It's a great one. But the thing about Dream Horse was I went in predisposed not to like it all that much. Now, on the one hand, I'm just thrilled to see new movies. So we, like, today, we could have picked, like, the worst possible movie and I would have been excited about it. You know, my God, it just came out and I loved it. No, and I didn't love it. I hated it, but I just loved being able to see it, you know. But in this case, I actually surprised myself. I was not expecting much from Dream Horse. And push come to shove, I'm not enthusiastic about it. But you know what? It's so enjoyable. It's just such a winning picture in a lot of ways that I liked it more than I thought I would. So Marie, let me hand it back to you now because we're going to start to enumerate some of the reasons why we do like it.
Now, I'll just put it out there that I'm a sucker for this kind of movie, you know, where you build up my sympathy and then, you know, that, you know, of course, they're going to have difficulties and setbacks, but they're going to prevail in the end because it's a true story. You already know how it's going to end. You could literally look it up. But more than that, it wouldn't be a good movie if they disappointed you, if they dashed your hopes at the end. Nobody wants to see that, right? So you know how it's going to go. So I would say, the main failing of this movie, if there is one, is that there's really no tension. I mean, you're not ever really worried about the outcome, except for, you know, the individual people involved. They do a nice job with that. I would venture to say that the reason this movie succeeds is because of Toni Collette, but I'm anxious to hear what you say. But I also would like to sort of let people know who haven't seen it yet. You saw it at the Charles. It's been a while. It's been over a year since I've been to the Charles. I can't even remember what a ticket costs. I just want to tell people who are thinking of renting it that it's available on Amazon Prime for $19.99. And they make you buy it. Now, $19.99 is still not a bad deal if you think it's you and somebody going with you to the movies. But how does that compare with the theater, Mike?
I want to give consumer advice because that's our real function. That's our value. We can save you money. The tickets at the Charles matinee, I think, is $10 and the evening is $12. So, yeah, you're right. I mean, if you're going with a date or, you know, a group of people, that the money adds up fast there. If it's just yourself or yourself and somebody else, it's more reasonable. But I look on it really as part of the social contract. In other words, I think it's important to meet other human beings face to face. You know, the person selling you the ticket, concessions, all that stuff. It's part of the ritual. Here's an analogy that I'll make very quickly, and I won't belabor it. But there was an article I read recently in a newspaper that had to do with, now that corporations are asking their employees to come back to the office at least a few days a week, there was an interesting interview with one of the employees. She said, you know, I worked from home for a year and I could see the advantages and I loved it. And said, but it became a gray area. Where's my personal life? Where's my professional life? You know, it's not, somebody's still sending me emails at midnight, right? I mean, that kind of phenomenon. She said what she actually liked, and she surprised herself, what she liked about returning to the office was a clearer demarcation. She liked the fact that, you know, she had to drive 27 minutes, the average commute, you know, she had to drive to work, but it was a kind of decompression or a changeover from the life at home to the life in the office. And it did feel good, actually, to leave the office at, let's say, 5 o'clock. And, you know, and even if rush hour traffic's not so great, you know, to go through that, kind of decompress. By the time you get home, it's like you open the door and you're in that your other life. So, you know, going to the movies has somewhat that same. I watch a lot of movies at home, so I'm not averse to that. But there's something to be said for, you know, making a little bit of effort once in a while, you know, to actually do that. And I have to say, on a very pragmatic note as well, I have a good sized TV screen, but it's not as large as the screen at the Charles. And so I appreciate, for some movies particularly, having that full experience. I mean, you and I have talked about this many times before, but so often today when somebody says, oh, you know, I just saw Lawrence of Arabia for the first time, and which gets me excited. And then they say they watched it on a smartphone or something. And I'm thinking, you know, somehow that desert panorama doesn't work quite as well when the screen's just like this. But anyway, it's an interesting phenomenon. And even though movie theaters are not exactly packed these days, if you are going to watch a sports underdog story, you would like to have other people around you who, like Marie, like I sit there as a cool customer, right? I'm not the biggest fan of the genre, but I'd like to have somebody in the next row or at least 6 feet away, but somebody nearby who gets all worked up, all whoa, excited. And I'm sitting here now, I'm enough of a cynic. I'm thinking, what, you didn't think that was going to happen? But still, to have the person get kind of excited about it. I like that theater going experience. I think it does make a difference for a film like this. Which, you know, I saw it in a theater that was very quiet, so I might as well stay home, I suppose. But there's something to be said for the social ritual, if you will, of theater going. But I've gotten on a soapbox, so let me get off of it and turn it back to you.
All right. Well, I, of course, watched this in the privacy of my own home with my comfortable seating and better snacks than are available at movie theaters. So I want to know from you how it went over at the Charles. Were there a lot of people there? And did they like it, seem to like it? Did you think that the movie was worth seeing it on the big screen in terms of the music and the spectacle? But before you answer that question, I just wanted to say that what you set up is really kind of, you described something a lot of people have been talking about the pandemic, which is, you know, this whole work-life balance has been completely shattered for a lot of people. And what this brings us to the movie, one of the things I think is very well done in the movie is this sense of regular folks and their regular lives and how, you know, beat down people are by the drudgery of some of the menial jobs that the people in the movie have. So Toni Collette works at what she says is not a Tesco, it's a co-op, but for all intents and purposes, it's a big, you know, nameless, faceless supermarket. And there's these wonderful scenes that keep coming back to where she is following a floor polisher that moves very, very slowly. It's like a Zamboni for, you know, vinyl flooring, but it's so tedious and it's so, you can't speed it up. You just have to sort of follow it. it really underscores this sense that her character gives of, I have this menial job. And then in the evening, you know, I have another job where I'm pulling beers at the pub. Just a regular person trying to make ends meet who wishes there was more and would like something else to feel hopeful for, that this isn't all there is. So how well do you think it handles that idea, Mike, in addition to what was it like seeing it at the Charles? And did you think this movie rated a big screen treatment?
It doesn't necessarily merit the big screen treatment. However, the director is Welsh and has a pretty good sense of landscape, of village life and so on. And there are shots and entire sequences that work well on a big screen. Certainly the horse racing scenes work well on a big screen. A lot of the other stuff, frankly, I agree with you, Marie, that, you know, a lot of the domestic scenes and so on, they're fairly tight in terms of somebody's living room or a pub, whatever. No, you wouldn't necessarily need a 30-foot screen to appreciate a scene like that. But jumping to your second question, I would put it within a whole category of British films that I generally do like, namely working class comedies. You know, you could have, you know, a Mike Leigh type director, whatever, but just the real people, not the high end folks, you know, in London going to posh parties, but the people who live out in, well, yes, in Welsh villages, you know, and the characters in the film, some of them really just character types, but that's okay. Very likable character types. And Toni Collette is, you know, a really endearing actress in a role like this. And I thought it was perfect that they gave her not just one working class job, but two, which is oftentimes, frankly, the case for people, right? She works in that supermarket. She works in the pub. A lot of the scenes I enjoyed most were actually scenes in which not much happens. The ambiance, just you're pouring somebody a beer. You're just trading jokes and, you know, gossip and this and that. The tedium of working in a supermarket sometimes. There's something agreeable about just watching somebody go about her day that way. There's a quasi-documentary quality even to a film that otherwise can be rather fanciful and kind of almost fairy tale-like in terms of what's going to happen, as we'll describe it. So anyway, what made me like the film initially and really pulled me through what otherwise is a genre I don't care for a whole lot was the fact that I cared about the characters. I like them. I like hanging out with them, if you will, in the pub. And, you know, she's juggling those two jobs. And, you know, as a girl, as a young person, she had trained pigeons. She had some experience working with animals. So to start to jump us into the storyline per se, you know, she gets the idea that she could maybe get a horse and then, you know, in terms of breeding, you know, try to raise a racehorse. She has like no background here, right? So it's just the sincerity, the effort. In terms of how other people respond, some folks are kind of resistant, or in the case, and there's a running joke in the film I liked a lot. She does have a good husband, but he's kind of inattentive, I'll put it that way. So one of the running jokes they have among themselves, actually, is he's sitting watching, I would say television, they'd say telly, right? He's watching the telly, and she could say the most outrageous things, and he would just nod and say, well, that's good, dear. Sure, of course. Well, what if I, well, sure, dear, that sounds good to me. But that's when she starts to broach the idea of, you know, what if we got a horse and bred it and had a race? And, you know, it's like crazy on the face of it. But although there are some experts she can go to, a lot of it's just simply people in the village, one way or another, gradually coming around. And then it truly becomes a collective effort. You know, all those expressions about how it takes a village, it does take a village to raise a racehorse. And so this is a case where that's one of the likable things about the film. It might as well be a Frank Capra film at that point, where all the people gather around and help her. And if there are any bad eggs in the village, there aren't many. It's like, this is such a good group of people. How can you not root for them? And I think, Marie, that's also one reason why the film itself, I think, is winning long before the horse even gets on the track.
I'm glad you mentioned that, you know, it might as well be a Frank Capra movie, because you could almost see the people saying, you know, your money's not here. It's in the horse and in the feed and in the trainers and all that kind of stuff. Now, I want to mention that it has Damian Lewis in it as well, because he's recognizable from Homeland and some other projects. And he's also very good in this. My favorite scene in terms of what I think works is, you know, none of the people who are involved in this syndicate, and if nothing else, watch the movie to find out how a syndicate works, because I didn't know this till I watched it. All the people involved, they don't have really the money to set aside to, you know, for horse training, but they're all looking to have a piece of something bigger than the lives that they are leading. And so one of the best scenes is one of the guys who's got three jars that he's putting his money in each month. One says food, one says beer, and the last one says horse. And it's just a wonderful, you know, everyday person kind of a scene that I thought really helped you pull for these people, because you saw how they did it in a very funny but visual way. Now, I don't know if people from Wales think Toni Collette, she's Australian. Do we not have anybody Welsh? They did consider Catherine Zeta-Jones for this role and decided she was too glamorous because the real person she's based on is just a regular person, not a, you know, international beauty like Catherine Zeta-Jones. And I think Toni Collette gives it that everyday person kind of quality. She even looks a little bit like the woman. And Toni Collette does not mind playing plain. She's kind of like Frances McDormand in that way. And I could kind of see Frances McDormand doing this role. What do you think?
It's interesting you mentioned Catherine Zeta-Jones. I saw her once in an event with her husband, Michael Douglas, and I stood and stared. I thought, this is one of the most beautiful people I've ever seen in my life. I mean, drop dead gorgeous, and not just in terms of her physical appearance, but how she dressed, how she presented herself. To directly address your comment, Marie, when I think about the image she has and what I was looking at, you know, up close, I thought there's no way she could, I shouldn't say no way, but she really would not be well cast in this particular role. Not that this woman working in a supermarket in a pub has to be plain or unattractive. No, I don't mean that at all. Simply mean she can be good looking, but not like a knockout. Because if she looks like a knockout, at some level, come on, fess up. You're going to sit there thinking, she's a supermodel. What's she working in a supermarket for? I mean, it's distracting, right? And if they try to plane her up, try to make up whatever, sometimes it's too self-conscious, right? Where you find yourself saying, oh, that's really Catherine Zeta-Jones under the makeup. You know, so it's smart actually to have someone like Toni Collette, who certainly is a very attractive actor, but you don't find yourself like turning your head and going, whoa, you know, look at this supermodel. No, she can play plain. She's done a lot of movies where she's proved the acting skill. Emma, Muriel's Wedding, The Hours, Knives Out. I mean, she's done a variety of roles, but you're right, Marie, and a lot of them not really glamming it up. She's willing to play plain, or at least like, you know, here I am, I'm the character. I'm not in high heels, or I'm not, you know, all dressed for the ball or something. And so I thought she was really good in this because she's a very likable actor. And, you know, she is easy on the eyes, to kind of put it bluntly, but not in a way where you think she should be in a beauty pageant or something. It's just, no, I mean, you know, she's a very presentable. And the thing is, you know what, as an Australian, and I like to think I'm pretty good with accents, but honestly, I'm not that good as in like, well, as an Australian actor, how is she at playing Welsh? I mean, I would defer to anyone who really knows the accents. But for me, as a dumb American viewer, I thought, yeah, that's fine. I believe her. You know, I'm not picking up otherwise. And I thought she was very convincing in that. One other thing I'll add, Marie, to your comments, when you mentioned how the other ordinary people, and a lot of them really do look like they were cast off the streets. I mean, you know, these are professional actors, I would think, for the most part, but they look like real people, right? Whether they are or not, they look like real people. So when they're putting basically like their pennies in the jar, that's another one of the Capra touches, because you don't have like some big sugar daddy who comes along and says, hey, I'll bankroll it, you know, easy street. No, it's all the people like with I love the way you put it, with the jars. You know, this is for food. This is for rent. This is for the horse, whatever. And that's how collectively, again, as a group, there's kind of populist spirit here. They put it together. And it's worth pointing out at this point that the name of the horse will be Dream Alliance. So again, that sense of dream, almost like in a fairy tale sense of, you know, can wish fulfillment, can it come true? But the alliance, again, this is one of the things that it's a very, you know, often even silly movie, but on a dramatic level, this is what helps hold it together, is that these people are all in it together. So sure, I'm rooting for that horse. As I said earlier, I'm rooting for this horse long before it actually hits the track.
Now, I would say as a Toni Collette movie, this is a serviceable Toni Collette performance. I've liked her in other things like Muriel's Wedding and The United States of Tara and Knives Out that you mentioned. I also think that in terms of a horse movie, I would say that Secretariat from 2010 was better. I would say Seabiscuit from 2003 is better. Even National Velvet in 1944 in terms of horse movies. You can give me your opinion in a second. And also just briefly, how would this movie, if it fit in at all, work into your British film class?
Well, I've got to say,
way,
I don't.
By the way, you're teaching in the fall.
Thank you for the commercial plug. I always appreciate it. Honestly, I don't spend a lot of time thinking about horse movies, but when I do, Marie, I agree with you. I agree with you completely. When you mentioned like Secretariat and others, I mean, I've seen all those films. They are actually better, I would say, in a technical sense. The horse racing sequences in this film are serviceable. They're fine. There's nothing like overtly wrong with them, quote unquote. But you know what? The other films are more polished. Let's put it that way. They have a bit more production value. The horse racing sequences are a bit longer and a bit more drawn out in a good sense, really pulling you into a race. Not that they were perfunctory here, But the real interest of the film, the likability, has more to do with that cast of small village characters, right? Once it gets to the track, yeah, I do care about, you know, who's going to win this and that. But when it got into the home stretch there, the finale is at the Welsh Grand National, which means nothing to me, right? But in the movie made it clear that it was a really big deal. So I thought, oh, this is a big deal. At that point, you could almost, you know, watch it next to Rocky II or something. There's the point where it becomes, for my taste, a bit too formulaic. You know, that's the point where if I feel like my knee going out, it's the knee-jerk response, like, oh, I got to get worked up here. It's the big race and so on. And it was filmed well enough. But Marie, back to your point, the other films you mentioned are all, I would say, superior in terms of, strictly speaking, racetrack action.
Well, I think we need to switch gears and talk about an actual Australian movie, The Dry, which was filmed in Melbourne. And if you decide to stream it, it's $6.99 to rent from Amazon Prime. But of course, Mike, you saw it in the theater. Now, $6.99 is a deal, you know, in terms of also time, you know, not spent in the car, parking, and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. But my first reaction watching this movie, and by the way, I thought Eric Bana was wonderful in it, was it reminded me of Picnic at Hanging Rock. It's kind of the story of the, you know, this teenage picnic gone wrong in the past. And then, you know, Eric Bana comes back to his hometown and kind of discovers that something that has happened is actually harking back to an old crime from the past. So Mike, by the way, when you do British film, does it cover Australian film at all?
No, it doesn't. And I once had a student, admittedly, she was biased because she was from Australia. She wanted me to put together a course on Australian cinema. So me being the, you know, the ultra academic, I start buying Australian movies thinking at some point in the future, in 2030, you know, I'll do this. But Picnic at Hanging Rock is one of my favorite Australian films. And it's actually a very interesting comparison that you make there. But in terms of this film specifically, with Eric Bana, when I think about him, I go back to relatively early in his career. What were the career-defining performances? Think about him as Hulk in 2003 or Troy in 2004. There's a macho quality for sure, right? You know, he's going to be the toughest guy in the block. That plays to, and he's done a lot of movies since then, but that quality plays to advantage in The Dry because he plays a Melbourne policeman who returns to his hometown after a long absence. He's investigating a murder, a horrible family. This is a film where you got to be careful not to have spoilers with a film like this. But basically, there's this been horrible murder involving a family, including one of his old high school friends. So there's that to take into account. But it's a two-pronged thing. He's investigating this, but what makes it a difficult investigation is not just trying to figure out what happened, but the fact that back in the day when he was in high school, one of his friends died in a mysterious drowning incident. So the film has the present day investigation, but constantly flashes back to whatever happened all those years ago. And a lot of the people in town don't like him. They don't trust him. They think he had something to do with that girl's murder. And he was dating her after all, that girl's murder all those years ago. Now, to cut to the chase on this, and I wish the film would cut to the chase a bit more often, it's almost 2 full hours. And it's a rather leisurely investigation, partly just because of the pacing of the present day investigation, which does take its time. I'm thinking, come on, speed it up. You know, we're Americans. We want like fast action here. Solve it. Get it to court. There's that. It's kind of leisurely that way. And then constantly, the flashbacks, for my taste, happen too often. They are effective because they really do make you wonder what actually happened from this camera angle or that one. But they happen so often that, frankly, it kind of slows down the overall pacing. So I was not a big fan of the film, but it always held my interest because I do want to find out what the solution, both to the present day investigation and the one all those years ago. And the film does a pretty good job actually of balancing its characters and its themes to really keep you with it, even though, again, it has some yawn inducing moments where it's like, it's the big open landscape. I appreciate it. But, you know, are we going to watch him walk across that dusty road again? You know, it takes its time sometimes. What do you think?
I agree with you on all of your points. I will say that I did appreciate the stark scenery of Australia because I have actually visited that country and I can appreciate, you know, some of the things they're trying to put across. It's a stark beauty because the reason it's called The Dry is because it's after this drought. So everything is extremely dry. And of course, what they flash back to is a time when there was no drought. The characters keep going through the riverbed, the dry riverbed, where, you know, years and years ago, when it was lush and full of water, these tragedies happened. So the scenery is absolutely stark and beautiful. And the repercussions of the drought are, you know, reflected upon a couple of different ways. I mean, there's a moment where somebody tries to take a shower and there's no water. There's a car that is vandalized and they need to clean up with some dirty water because that's all you've got. Those scenes, I think, are kind of good in terms of giving you this Australian viewpoint, because, you know, this is something that they see happening and they know how to, you know, react to it. I also found the flashbacks very confusing. I don't think that was very well done, because I, you know, it was hard to understand whether you were where you were in the story. I thought that was actually kind of a fail. This is based on a book which I haven't read, and a detective character that I don't know if they intend to reprise, because they call it, you know, the Aaron Falk series. So I don't know if this is a way of packaging Eric Bana to do subsequent movies with the same character. If they did that, did you think this was a good jumping off point to, like, sort of put the stake in where, you know, you loved him in The Dry. Now, you know, we're going to take him out of Melbourne where we filmed this, although it looks like the outback, and, you know, have him solve other crimes. Do you think that would be successful?
I have not read, as with you, I have not read the source novel. I spend too much time watching movies and need to read more. So I haven't read it. However, having read about the film, it's a series of novels with the same detective. And reviews of this film almost all indicated that they saw it as a launching pad for a series of films with the same detective, which I could see, actually, just in terms of filmmaking. In terms of the fact that it's based on a novel, the novel has what they call a page-turner quality. I mean, based on what I've read about the novel, that doesn't work particularly well in the film sometimes. The film is full of red herrings, and sometimes you can just feel like they're yanking the chain too much. And I agree with you, Marie, that the flashbacks are deliberately confusing because we're meant to be mystified, trying to figure it out. But sometimes you can push that to an extreme. Sometimes I just thought they were what I call yanking the chain. They were just like, come on now, just give us a straight shot of what happened there. Don't keep stringing us along that way. There are so many red herrings in it in terms of what would actually happen in terms of character motivation. That element of manipulation, I'm wagering, might work a little better on the page where you can kind of work it through. On screen, it sometimes seems kind of abrupt or arbitrary even. So without spoiling anything in terms of how it plays out, I did sometimes feel like they were just, you know, come on now, you know, that kind of response, like, you know, twist it this way, twist it that way. And that's one reason also why the film goes almost 2 hours. It just, I agree with you that it's an austerely beautiful landscape. But when you have all those twists and turns playing out a bit too slowly sometimes against it, it gives you time to think about, you know, implausibility of one thing or another. Or Marie, as you say, with the flashbacks, why that camera angle? Like, doesn't anyone see it straight on? You know, and so that's the point where you feel like they're kind of pulling the strings within the story. What do you think?
I'm 100% in agreement with you on all of those points. I would just add that although I thought Eric Bana did a great job with the role, I did, you know, kind of expect a Hulk moment. I think that's the downside of him being, you know, mostly associated with the Hulk. You know, I kept waiting for him to get angry, and you wouldn't like him if he's angry. But that does bring us to the end of this show. Don't forget to check out our other episodes of At the Movies with Mike and Marie on dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And you can also find us on Spotify and Pandora under Dragon Digital Radio. But that takes us to the end of this show, and we will see you at the movies.
We'll see you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.